Good evening, everybody. My name is Elizabeth, and I am an addict and an alcoholic. Abe, Chris, thank you for inviting me to come here and share. I'm going to just start out at the beginning and tell you what it was like and what happened and what it's like now, because that's the way I was taught when I got to these rooms. So I took my first drink when I was 14 years old. I grew up a very privileged lifestyle. I went to private performing arts high school in Boston, Massachusetts. And one night we all went out drinking in a day hopper's car, and we drank a bottle of Tanqueray gin and got back to the dormitories, and I threw up all night. And I was so sick. And the next day I got called in front of the disciplinary committee with all the rest of the girls that were out drinking. And after I told my story, the head of the school said to me, he said, next time you come in here, you better get your story straight. And so I blacked out that first time that I drank. I didn't remember the story. I didn't remember what we did or how much we drank, but I was in trouble. And from there, I went on to smoking pot and doing cocaine a little bit on the side while I was in high school. And, I graduated high school, and I decided that I wanted to become an actress, and I went to college, and I went to University of Denver, and I studied theater for a year, and I drank my way through college. I joined a fraternity as opposed to joining a sorority because I thought it would be more fun, and I could drink more and party more, and I did. And after I left there, I went to school in London for a year and I studied Shakespeare, and I drank and drugged there a little bit too, but not as much because the school said that we weren't supposed to do that. They had a rule that if you drank, you were in trouble. And so one night I went to an opening of a bar and I drank, and I was hungover the next day and I was in school. And the British diction teacher said to me, he called me, he said, would the Northern American girl with the boring voice please stand up now? And I didn't know he was talking about me, but clearly he could smell the alcohol coming off my body. And he goes, would the Northern American girl with the boring voice please stand up now? And I looked around the room and I realized he was talking about me. And he made me get up and he made me run around the room and yell my sonnet out, my Shakespeare sonnet out, and I was sweating and alcohol was coming out of me. And he said, good, now get it straight next time, lady. And so I had that experience in London. And then I went to Hollywood and I wanted to become an actress. And it was pretty much a time period when everybody was blonde and big boobed on television. It was a time during Charlie's Angels time. And I was a redhead and I was flat chested. And so I didn't really fit into the typical casting call in Hollywood at the time. But I tried and I got into some theater and I got an agent and I auditioned for some films. But I mainly partied. And I had a drug dealer boyfriend who sold cocaine, so I could do all the cocaine I wanted to do. And that's pretty much what I did. I went out, I danced, I did cocaine, I drank. I never thought I had a drinking problem. I always thought I just had a drug problem. And I would take ecstasy too. And so my mother passes away. She has a drunk driving accident when I'm 21 years old. And I'm living in Los Angeles. And she died in that drunk driving accident. And 2 months later, I proceed to have the same accident. I hit a post at 80 miles per hour on Sunset Boulevard in Hollywood. And I was so drunk and high that my body collapsed underneath the dashboard. So I truly was a miracle that I lived. They said the impact was 80 miles per hour into a metal post. And so I knew there was a God. And when I woke up in that hospital, I asked for paper and pen and I wrote a letter to God. And I said, God, please save me from myself. Please, may I stop drinking and drugging. Please help me get better. And my father showed up and he said, what do you want to do? Do you want to get well? Come to Washington, D.C. and where I live and you can get better. And so he said to me, when you get to D.C., look for the sign that says PI on it. And I said, okay. So I got to the hospital and I got on an airplane and I flew to D.C. and I looked for the sign that said PI on it. And I asked the guy, I said, excuse me, what does PI stand for? And he said, Psychiatric Institute. And I was like, oh, okay. So my dad had committed me to a psychiatric institute and I stayed there for 2 months. And at that recovery center, I learned about the steps. I learned about the program. And I knew that when I got out of there, I had to go to sober living. And so I did that. I got out of the treatment center and I went to sober living and I got a sponsor and I started working the steps. And I made a lot of friends in the fellowship. And then slowly I got away from meetings and my career started taking off. And I started drinking again. As I said, I never thought I was an alcoholic. I only thought I was a drug addict. So when I was in that hospital in Los Angeles, I considered myself to be a cocaine addict. And I didn't think drinking was a problem. So I proceeded to start drinking and working. And my work was special events. And I started out volunteering to George Bush's campaign in 1988. And when he won, I got hired on to the White House to do presidential advance, which is when you go out into the city ahead of the president and set it up for him to come. And so I went to presidential advance school and I learned how to do that. And I worked for the White House for 4 years doing mainly doing motorcades. And it was a fun job, a lot of hard work, but I drank. But my drinking wasn't really a problem and I wasn't doing any drugs. And so George Bush lost the election. And so I was out of a job. So I joined a PR agency and worked for them for like 6 months and decided that it was time for me to go out on my own. So I opened my own company. And it was a special event company. And we were very successful. Our first client was the Pope. We did the Pope's visit to Baltimore, which was 9 events in 12 hours. And I was with His Holiness all day long. And it was a very special day for me because I was Catholic and I had never thought that I could be so close to His Holiness and be a part of something so big. And so it was one of the most incredible experiences of my life. But I drank through it. After that, I went on to work on the Olympics for Coca-Cola. And we went on to do the Lady Diana dress tour, which was taking Lady Diana's dresses around the country to different venues. And we did the Promise Keepers Million Man March. And that was pretty amazing. A million men on the monument grounds. And we did all the logistics for that. When I got back to DC after the Olympics in Atlanta, I kept thinking, why were the Olympics in Atlanta when Washington, DC is such a pretty city? And then I did some research and I found out that 67% of Olympic Games are played in nations' capitals. And so then the United States Olympic Committee put out a notice that they were looking for cities interested in bidding on the Olympics. And I thought, wow, this is an opportunity, but you need to get a letter from the mayor acknowledging that you could represent the city. And so somehow I got to the mayor, Mayor Barry, and I got a letter and I was able to go and represent Washington at that meeting. And they gave us 3 months to raise $100,000 to get in the running to be part of the bid for the 2012 Olympic Games. And so I worked steadily on that bid, doing plans of how to re-outfit stadiums, doing plans for opening ceremonies and closing ceremonies, doing plans for children's programs in the community, inner city children programs. And the bid was quite strong. But then there was a bunch of businessmen in town who wanted to take control of the bid. And they wanted to combine Baltimore and Washington's bid, when all along my bid included Baltimore. So it was kind of a hoax. These businessmen came together, and I had raised $500,000 from the Mobil Oil Corporation. And these businessmen told Mobil Oil to put it into their account and not into my account. And I lost the bid, and the mayor turned on me. And the only way I could lose the bid was if the mayor decided to go with another group by June 30th. And I'll never forget, on June 30th, I went to the newspaper rack at midnight, and I found the paper, and it said, bid gone to new group. And I was devastated. And so I started doing drugs again. And my drinking started spinning out of control. I was completely devastated. I just was lost. And so I lost my business. I lost my apartment. I lost my car. I was homeless. I was living in hotel rooms. And I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. And my brother stepped in and said, come live with me. So I went to live with my brother, and he and his wife put me in a treatment center. And at that treatment center, I got a scholarship. And I got a scholarship to a treatment center in Florida. Now, I've never gotten a scholarship to anything in my life. So I guess I was the sickest one in the room at this treatment center. And I went to Florida. And I went to that treatment center. And while I was there, I was fighting a lawsuit against the businessman who stole the bid from me. And the lawsuit was a $10 million lawsuit where it was said that they stole the bid from me and that they bribed the mayor $1 million to give the bid away. And my lawyers ended up proving that to be true. And they ended up settling out of court with me about a year and a half later. And so when I got out of that treatment center, I went to a halfway house, and I was living at that halfway house with men and women in Delray Beach, Florida. And I missed curfew, and so I got thrown out, and I got an apartment. But then I became homeless again because I couldn't hold a job. And I started drinking again, and I started drugging again. And then I won the lawsuit, and I got a lot of money. And when I got all that money, I just started partying more. And I remember I was in Miami Beach, and I was out partying, and I would go to the clubs and I would dance all night. And I remember one night, I was in a nightclub, and it was like 3 a.m, and I was dancing, and I was by myself on the dance floor, and it was my birthday, and I was all alone. And I prayed to God. I said, God, please give me a child. Give me something bigger than myself so that I can stop drinking and drugging. And I met a man that night, and I went home with him, and I got pregnant. And I married that man, and I had the baby. But when I had the baby, it was a rough going. I had been in hypertension for about 4 weeks prior to giving birth, and my blood pressure hit 220, and so they had to do an emergency C-section on me. And my son came out fine. He wasn't premature, and I was fine. Except that my lung was 100% filled with fluid, and they missed that in the x-rays. And so about midnight, the night after I birthed my son, I had a heart attack. And I woke up in ICU the next day, and I did not know what had happened. All I remembered was that I was gasping for air in the hospital. Well, that night in the hospital, before I had the heart attack, a friend came to visit me, and I thought he brought me a downer of powder to do, and I can't remember what it was called. I think it was called Special K, but it was cocaine, and I snorted it, and I'm sure that's what triggered the heart attack. So when they found the cocaine in my system, they decided that Department of Children and Families was going to step in, and they were going to take my son away from me. And so I stayed in the hospital. I was very sick for about 2 months. And so I got to stay in the hospital with my son. But the day they let me leave the hospital, my son left with one of the social workers from the Department of Children and Families. And I went home alone. And I went straight to a meeting. I was so desperate. I was so sad. I was so lost. And I went to this meeting and I shared. And everyone said, keep coming back. And I said, okay. And I went home and I hired a lawyer. And within 2 days, I got my son back with a mandate that I had to have a nanny 24 hours and that I had to do drug court, which meant I had to go pee in a cup every week. And I was put on a bunch of pain pills because I had lost a bone in my knee. And so I was taking pain pills and drinking pretty heavily. And the nanny was taking care of my son. And I was pretty much a mess. You know, I was drinking, taking pills, feeding my baby, trying to put my baby to bed, but mainly letting the nanny do it. Going to drug court, but getting a special drink to drink before I go so that my pee is clean. And I would buy those special drinks that cleaned your urine out before you went to pee in a cup so I could continue drinking. That was the madness of it all. And I got off the pills, but I continued to drink. And it was no longer a party anymore for me. I was home alone with an infant, and I was drinking. And I was hiding bottles from myself, and I was having seizures, and I didn't know what I was going to do. The doctors in the hospital kept telling me if I kept doing what I was doing, I was going to die. And yet I continued to drink. And eventually my family did an intervention and got me to a treatment center on the west coast of Florida. And at that treatment center, I had a psychiatrist, and we had a family meeting. And the psychiatrist told my father, he goes, if she ever drinks again, you need to throw her under the bus. And so I got out of that treatment center, and I went to a couple of meetings. I didn't get a sponsor, and I ended up drinking again. And so my father put me right back in that same treatment center again 3 weeks later, and I stayed there for about 6 weeks. And then I got out, and my father had taken my son, and I had nowhere to go. So I checked into this flea bag motel. It was like $40 a night, and it had a cement floor. And I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. I felt completely devastated. I was swollen beyond belief. My whole body was swollen. My organs were failing. And I remember getting on my hands and knees and praying to God and asking God to help me. And I called my godmother in Portland, Oregon, and she said, there's a place you can go. And I said, where? And she said, it's called the Plume Rescue Mission, and it's a women and children program, and you can go there and you can get better, and it's free. And so she said, all I need to do was write a letter. And so I wrote a letter, and they accepted me. And I flew out to Oregon, and I did that program, and I did it quite seriously. And we did a step process called the Genesis process, where it's like a fourth step on steroids. And that's where I truly met my higher power. I watched a video with one of my counselors, and it was about a guy who survived the being stung by a stingray on the Great Barrier Reef. and how he met God on his way to the hospital and how he survived that sting and didn't die. And I asked my counselor, I said, how do I get what he has? He has a peace about him and I want that peace. And she said, all you need to do is pray with me. And so she took my hand, prayed together. And for the first time in my life, I'm going to be okay. It was the first time in my life I felt like I didn't have to perform anymore or put on a show. I always felt like in my life that I had to put on a show for everybody and that I always had to be perfect and that I always had to be, you know, dressed right, looking right, performing. I constantly was performing. And the biggest thing that happened to me was that I realized that I didn't have to perform anymore, that I could just be me and I could be me and just be okay. And so I stayed in that facility for 9 months and graduated and I got out and I got an apartment and I asked for my son back from my father. And he said I could have my son back if I did 3 months out of that treatment center and stayed sober. And so I did. And my father gave me my son back, and it was about a year that I had been away from my son. And he said, why don't you come to D.C.? And so I moved to D.C. with my son, where I had lived before. And I stayed sober. I mainly stayed sober through church and through God. And I wanted to take care of my son and be the very best mother I could possibly be because I felt like I had done such wrong by my son by being an alcoholic and a drug addict and not taking care of him when he was young and letting a nanny do all the work. And by having my father take him away from me, I had such guilt and shame around that, that I really wanted to be the very best mother I could possibly be. And so I focused on my son and we ended up moving back down to Florida. And I didn't go to the program. I didn't use the fellowship and I ended up drinking again after about 7 years. And that drunk lasted for about 6 weeks. And then my father stepped back in and took my son from me and said that I needed to go back to treatment in Portland. And so I went back to treatment in Portland for about 6 weeks and I got better again and I got out and I went back to Florida and I got my son and I moved us out to Portland. And when we got out to Portland, I really only had about one friend out here, but I wanted to get away from my father. My father had been taking care of me for all the years that I was out of the treatment center and there were a lot of strings attached to it. And I couldn't live with all the strings that were to it. I was having to lie to my father all the time. And so when I got to Portland, I was with my son. We were all alone. I got him into school. I got an apartment. And I felt alone. And I had a fellowship. I had God in my life. And I had a higher power and I had my spirituality and I had church, but I didn't have fellowship and I didn't have friends. And so I ended up drinking again. And when this time I drank, I would go to the toilet and I would throw up and I would drink again and I would throw up and I would drink again and I would throw up. So my body was physically rejecting the alcohol. And I decided to go to a meeting. And I remember going to this meeting and there was a woman there and I liked what she had to say. And I asked her if she'd be my sponsor. And she said, yes. And so I worked with her for about 30 days and then I ended up drinking again. And then I started throwing up again. And then she finally said to me, she said, Elizabeth, make a decision. And I said, what do you mean? She says, make a decision. You can pour that bottle out and stop throwing up and go to a meeting, or you can sit there in misery and keep drinking. And somehow a light went off and I was like, okay. And I poured the bottle of wine out and I went to a meeting and I started going to meetings and working with my sponsor and doing the steps and really making a commitment to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm going to be celebrating 8 years on February 28th. And it's been a long road. You know, it's been a very long road. There's been very many ups and there's been very many downs. And I truly believe that the fellowship has saved my life, because now I have friends in the program who I can count on, who I can call upon. I have a sponsor who tells me great things and who walked me through the book. We read the book from the cover to cover together, and we worked the steps together. And I did a fourth and fifth step with her. Just recently, last year, we went through the steps again and read the book again. And so life today is really good. And I work a program. I go to a meeting about four times a week. I work with a sponsor. I'm a sponsor to another woman. And I work the steps with her. And that keeps me sober. And I try and stick in the steps in, you know, 10, 11, and 12. Taking my inventory at night, making sure I haven't wronged anybody. Making sure that I'm being close to God. If I have wronged somebody, I try and make amends right away, because I can't really live with myself if I've done wrong by somebody. And I, prayer and meditation are so important to me. I get up every morning and I read the Bible and I pray and I meditate and I read devotional books. And sometimes I share my devotional books with my friends. In the morning, I send them screenshots of devotionals I've read to try and share the message of God. And without doing that ritual every morning, my day is not straight. I need to get up every morning and read the Bible and pray and do devotionals, because that's what keeps me sober, is having that relationship with my higher power. Because I turn my will and my life over to my higher power every day, all night, and the very next day. And I truly believe that my higher power is what keeps me sober today. And the fellowship. Having all of you guys keeps me sober and keeps me on the right track. I think I've talked long enough. I don't really have much more to share, except that I thank you all for listening and letting me share my story. And there's parts I left out, but you know what? You got the gist of it. And so thank you for letting me share.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thank you, everybody.
Yeah, thanks, Elizabeth.
Thanks. That was a powerful story.
Proud of you, Elizabeth. That was really...